Welcome to Flights of Fantasy, your romanticy podcast book club. I'm Christina, joined by my book besties, Kim and Anna. And together we're diving into the characters, theories, lore, and magic behind all your favorite fantasy romance books.
Hi, book besties. Welcome to ACOTAR Revisited, our deep dive back into the series that started it all. We are so excited to be here discussing the novella, A Court of Frost and Starlight, from the ACOTAR series by Sarah J. Maas. But before we give our official spoiler warning, Christina has some announcements.
I sure do. First and foremost, guys, it is a very exciting month over on Patreon. The time has officially come. We are covering Asriel's bonus chapter from A Court of Silver Flames, arguably the most important piece of text in existence right now when it comes to ACOTAR 6. So there is so much to break down there. All of it is so important. We're so excited about this episode. So that will be a part of our SJM miniseries for tier 2 over on Patreon. Also, for both tiers, we're covering part 1 of the new season of Bridgerton. I will also be doing a cauldron chat for tier 2, covering the Dusk Court, a deep dive into the Dusk Court. If you know, you know, there's a lot to break down there. And we will also be doing a Romance Reads book chat covering The Wild Card by Stephanie Archer, one of our favorite Hucky Romance series. So yes, come join all the fun over on Patreon at patreon.com/flightsoffantasypodcast. We would love to have you. All right, Anna, let's do spoiler warning.
All right, spoilers from here on out for every book in the ACOTAR series.
Woo!
Let's kick off this episode. We are going to be discussing Elaine, Asriel, and Lucien. Because obviously, who is Asriel going to end up with? This is a big topic, and we're going to continue to talk about this. We started in Akawar, and we're going to continue to talk about it through Akasoft. But there are a couple things I want to quickly run through to note for everyone to pin for possibly Elaine's book that could be upcoming, hopefully soon. Everyone is at the townhouse, and Elaine has helped prepare dinner for everyone. She realizes that she still has her apron on, and she's apologizing, and she, you know, oh, I'm going to go take this off, and runs out of the room. Now, Cassian immediately dives in and starts to make his plate and eat. And Asriel basically admonishes him and is like, hey, we're going to wait until everybody is seated at the table before we all dive in into the food.
It's a big moment. Yeah.
It shouldn't feel that way, but it does. It's enough of a moment that Feyre goes, what was that about? Like mind speak to Rhysand. And what Rhysand says is, let's just say it hit a little close to home. There are some scars when it comes to how his mother was treated. Many scars. His mother, who had been a servant near slave when he was born. And afterward, none of us bothered to wait for everyone to sit, least of all Cassian. It can strike at odd times. And I think it's important to remember here that Asriel, obviously, his trauma, which Christina really went into in her cauldron chat on the Bat Boy's backstory. But remember, Asriel was kept in a dark little cell, and he was only allowed to see his mother once a week for an hour. And I think this can be taken in a couple different ways. Oh, Asriel has feelings for Elaine, and he wants to make sure that she is protected, and he's already setting us up for this like kind of protective man that he is. But I think Asriel looks at Elaine and sees someone delicate, someone untouchable. And I think he wants to preserve that. Are there possible feelings there? Yes, sure. But it also kind of gives me, personally, like Oedipus complex. We know little to nothing about his mother except that she was the one light in his life, right? And when he sees Elaine serving everyone and bringing dinner that she helped prepare, it triggers him because it reminds him that his mother wasn't ever shown respect, and he wants to make sure that the person who is helping them, this beautiful light that Elaine is, that she is treated with the same sort of respect that no one ever showed his mother. And Elaine is not a servant, but that's how it reads to me sometimes. I obviously also can 100% admit that, yes, could it be deeper than that? Could there be feelings? But that's what the Oedipus complex is finding attraction in someone who reminds you of their mother. And I do wonder if that's part of this here.
It's interesting. There's a lot of wording around him treating her gently and her treating him gently. And a lot of his trauma is wrapped up in his mom.
And I think another important thing to note from this dinner table scene is Elaine is speaking to Amryn, and she asks Amryn a very personal question. Did you choose his body? When you came back again, how did you choose his body? Were you given the option to change the body into something else? And what Amryn says is, you will never be able to be human again. She clocks what Elaine is trying to get at. And Elaine gets very prickly about it and cold, and she responds back to Amryn. But what Feyre notes, because it's Feyre's POV, is, I glanced at the others. Rhys was frowning. Cassian and Moore were both grimacing. and Asriel, dot, dot, dot. It was pity on his beautiful face, pity and sorrow as he watched my sister. And I don't know why this struck me. I think because when there is a male character who is in love with somebody and they look at the person that they're in love with, it's rarely with a sense of pity. If she's talking about wanting to go back to her old life, there would be a sense of longing. I mean, she does write sorrow here, but again, the word pity really stuck out to me. When you couple with how he looks at Mor, he does look at her with longing still.
Does he do that in this book?
Yeah, so what it says when they're at solstice is, as to his credit, gave Mor a smile of thanks, a blush creeping over his cheeks, his hazel eyes fixed on her. I looked away at the heat, the yearning that filled them.
Oh, wow.
So again, I go back to this idea of he looks at Elaine not so much out of this like need and love and lust, but out of this need to care and nurture. Whereas with Mor, there's still this sense of like longing and lust there that he still holds on to. It's just very different the way that he looks at both of them.
No, I totally agree. The word pity is tricky because I do see Asriel in that moment thinking, oh, she's hurting. I'm hurting for her. Oh, poor her.
Yeah.
But still, I don't know if that would be described as pity.
I think if he realized that she wanted to go back to being human. For example, with Lucien, there is a sense of frustration. There's a sense of, why does she want that male? Like, it hurts him. It physically aches him that Elaine wants this human person, not him. And with Asriel, Sarah doesn't write, he looks at Elaine with a sense of understanding or a sense of longing. It's a pity.
There's a lot going on there. There's so many different layers and levels and interesting things going on with Elaine and Asriel because they don't really speak. So, and there's so much going on behind the scenes there. But another really important Elaine-Asriel moment that we just have to talk about in this book is the gift giving. So Asriel has already asked Rhys, are we supposed to get the sisters' gifts? He kind of sputters around his words. And Rhys says, don't get the sisters' gifts. Let them give each other gifts. But Elaine gets Asriel a gift. And I want to just touch on this for a second.
Yes.
So they're there. They're passing out presents. Elaine says, oh, that's for me. And Asriel's face didn't do so much as shift at the words, not even a smile, as he opened the present and revealed, I had Maja make it for you. And Asriel's brows narrow. And she says, it's a powder to mix in with any drink. And everyone's quiet. And it's like, okay. And Elaine just smiles sheepishly. It's for the headaches everyone always gives you since you rub your temples so often.
Which
silence
is
again.
So cute, buddy.
So funny. And then this line. Asriel tipped his head back and laughed. I'd never heard such a sound, deep and joyous.
Aww.
Asriel masters himself enough to say, thank you. And then, this is in Ferris POV, I'd never seen his hazel eyes so bright. The hues of green amid the brown and gray, like veins of emerald. This will be invaluable, Asriel says. I love this. We've never seen Asriel laugh, much less laugh like this. My God.
Yeah.
Which is wild. And I think there is some wording there of like, I've never heard him laugh like that. I've never seen his eyes so bright.
Yeah.
That is there to help the reader think, does he have feelings for her?
Exactly.
Where those feelings are going, I don't know.
Yeah.
But this is the groundwork that's supposed to make the reader feel like, ooh, I'm picking up on this. Is there something there?
And remember, we have 9 months from the end of this book to when Akasov starts. But also, Christina, you said it in one of our Akawar episodes that Sarah is the queen of people finding somebody who they need in the moment, who helps them move forward to then eventually find who their end mate is or their end person.
You need different people at different times.
I think this
might be leaning that way. But
so Lucien does show up here and he is talking to Feyre, and Feyre is kind of trying to get what's going on with you and Jurien and Vasa, what's happening over there, because he's obviously helping out. And what he says is, he's referencing Jurien. He says, he keeps everything running. I think he'd have been crowned king by now if it wasn't for Vasa. A twitch of the lips, a spark in that russet eye. She's doing well enough, savoring every second of her temporary freedom.
The spark in his eye, you say?
I know, the spark in his russet eye. I'm like, Lucien, are we having feelings for Vasa?
I think he also kind of sparked up, kind of had this emotion run across his face when he talked about her in Akawar.
Yeah.
I love this. I also feel like there's something between her and Jurien. So like, I don't know if we're looking at like
other,
a love triangle or a thruple. I don't know, but I'm here for any of it, honestly.
Yes, I thought the same thing too, because the spark in that russet could also be knowing that there is tension between Vasa and Jurien and he's kind of laughing about it. It's like an inside joke. It could go either which way, but it is interesting to note. And also, Feyre here is not exactly the kindest. She kind of makes fun of Lucien and their little band of exiles, as he calls them, and she belittles it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not, I'm like, Pharaoh. It's like, be nice to him.
They are a band of exiles.
Yeah. But, you call yourself the Court of Drapes? Like, what do you mean?
Yeah. I don't know.
That this was sad for me for Lucien. He's found his people. Just because they're not your people doesn't mean that they're wrong and you can make fun of them. You know, I feel like she wants this for Elaine and for Lucien.
She's pushing her version of her happiness. She's pushing it onto Lucien and Elaine. She even turns to Elaine like, is he really so bad? And it's like, give the girl a break. She hasn't even been Fae for a year.
Right.
Like, let the woman come to terms.
And Elaine in that moment says, he doesn't know me. And then she says, I don't want a mate or a male, is what she says.
That's how Nesta feels too.
Yeah.
She's like, that's my last shred. If I claim a mate, then that is the last shred of their humanity, they feel like. It's easy for us to say, oh, you're so beautiful now and you're long-lived and you have these beautiful Fae males who want you, but that's not the life that they signed up for. It was taken from them, that choice.
Yes, and so a Fae male being like, you're mine, is like, well, what do you mean? Well,
I don't know you.
I don't know you.
I am nobody.
But to Lucien's credit, he is like, she does not want to be around me. I tried to get to know her and she literally physically won't let me. So why would I hang around here and just get kicked down every single day?
He says it physically causes him pain to be in the same. It hurts
him.
Yeah. And to his credit, he is not pushing it. He's like, I'm backing out. I'm not here to cause her pain. It hurts me that she's hurting.
Yes. And so now he's gone and found his own version of people who love and accept him and want him. Mm-hmm. And we should just be happy for him is all I'm saying. Fabra, come on.
Come on.
All right. Okay. Let's move on to more. Oh my goodness. Two POV chapters from more. And you would think these would have been just a treasure trove of endless answers. And that, unfortunately, that's not the case.
Could not be more incorrect.
But here's what they are. We do get an Eris flashback. Again, not any real new information here, except for I do want to note that Eris says, no one touch her. Do not touch her. No one touch her. 3 times. Mm-hmm. I know we have known that he said, no one touch her. If you do, she's our responsibility. But again, just really hammered in the amount of times he says, no one touch her. There has to be something tied to them touching her. Also, the main real takeaway in this scene is how fucking horrible and horrific it is. She's in so much pain. Mm-hmm. It is horrible.
Yeah.
And I do understand if we're going to get an Eris redemption arc, this is a bad look. He walks away from her, leaving her in the dirt, dying with the nails in her, and says, like, why would I want Illyrian leftovers? She sullied herself. Leave her. And again, we are hoping he then goes and reports to Azriel to come get her.
I think he must.
Yeah, I think he must. But on page, Moore just sees them walking away and leaving her to die. That's what she's living with.
But I always remember the line that Eris says in Akawar when they meet with Kyr, that he looks at Moore and he says, you know the truth of what happened that day. And he won't answer to anybody else.
Yeah.
And he's like, only Moore can say what happened. So I feel like there's a part of the memory or something that we're missing or a deeper meaning here that Moore does know.
That she was reading the clues maybe or something?
Yeah, or her gift is truth. Like,
God, or she finally used her power?
I don't know.
Because we get Eris in this flashback say, I take it you do not wish to live here, Morgan. In her inner monologue, she would rather die, bleed out here. She would rather die and return as something wicked and cruel and shred them all apart. He must have read it in her eyes. A small smile curved his lips. I thought so. So a lot of people take this as a receipt that they are actually mates. Like, she didn't mean to be mind-speaking this to him.
Oh.
And something about him touching her was going to, like, accept the mating bond or something with the mating bond was going to happen.
Interesting. Okay.
But I think that he must have just read it in her eyes and was like, absolutely not. But I think maybe that's the moment. That's what he's talking about. It's like, you know that I was like, you don't want to live here, right? And I was like, I thought so. I'm going to leave you and pretty much save you from this.
Yes.
By leaving you.
Yeah. And we have a more deep dive that we did on our SJM miniseries where we kind of go into this a little bit more. But I really do think, I really hope that we get some really great era scenes in the future.
I feel like we have to. We just have to.
I know. Okay.
Another really interesting but infuriating moment is in this same more POV. She's sitting there at the table with Kyr. She hasn't spoken in this meeting. And she looks at Kyr. He's smiling at her with satisfaction. And she's realizing he's noted that she isn't speaking, that she's not standing up for herself, that she's not speaking and being this proud woman she pretends to be. And in her monologue, she's like, say something, say something. And she doesn't. Then they go to leave. And in her inner monologue, she thinks, pathetic, cowardly and pathetic. Truth is your gift. Truth is your curse. Say something. But the words to strike down her father did not come. What does truth is your gift, truth is your curse mean?
I don't know, Christina. Every time we get something with more, I am more confused.
Everything in this made sense. Pathetic, cowardly, pathetic. Say something. Like,
truth
fine.
Is your gift.
Truth is your gift, truth is your curse. So this to me reads, this little paragraph, if I take it totally out of context, reads to me, pathetic, cowardly, pathetic. Truth is your gift, truth is your curse. Say something. If I knew nothing about this, I would think this means she cannot speak unless she's speaking truth. That's why she can't say something. Because she's like, truth is your gift, truth is your curse. Say something. I couldn't say anything. She's like, oh, I wish I could say this thing to strike him down and say all this stuff about myself, but I can't. So like, is it truth is your curse? You can only speak the truth?
Yes.
But she definitely doesn't speak the truth at times in the books.
Does she?
Right? Right? Did I just unlock something?
I don't know because
does she not?
Now I want to go. I guess I have to reread the series. I actually don't know that, Christina, because she lies to herself. I mean, she says, I've been lying to myself.
Yeah.
But the fact that she never talks about her feelings with Asriel, I wonder now if the reason is in order to be honest with Asriel, she has to also share her own truths because she cannot lie. And she's not ready to do that.
Oh my God, did I just uncover something about more?
I absolutely love this because this would make so much sense. Truth is my gift. I am Morrigan, so you know what I speak. Like when she's with the human queens and she's revealing the Valeris.
Oh my God, wait. But that's why in that meeting, she was like, I am Morrigan. You should trust me.
You know my gift is truth. Yeah.
I cannot lie to you.
How have we never thought about this? My mind is blown. I pass my sleuthing crown to you. This was a brilliant nugget.
Is this
And
it?
I am now running with this until I am told otherwise.
I am now going to go back and read every single thing she ever says.
Absolutely. Like, yeah, I think that's what this means. But also, like, I still want to know why Mor is the person that Rhysand brings out when Cassian and Asriel and his army's fault. Like, that still doesn't make any sense to me because I don't know. What is she going to do? Walk out there and truth bomb everyone?
Oh, my God.
Like, I'm about to lay down some truths and y'all about to be so scared.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God. I'm so here for this.
Wow.
Okay.
Okay.
That's canon now until we're told otherwise.
That was really fun to experience live. Okay.
Amazing.
So also the beginning of Mor's other chapter, I think, does actually prove this as well. So the beginning of chapter 4 starts with, she lied to Feyre. Sort of. She was going to the Winter Court, just not as soon as she'd said. So I think this is her telling us, I had to get around it.
Yeah.
I had to tell her something that wasn't a lie because I cannot speak a lie.
Untruths. So she is going to the Winter Court, but she's making a little pit stop along the way. That's not a lie.
Right. That's not a lie.
That's a detour.
My God.
Absolutely. This is a fae. This is the way fae make bargains. You have to be careful with your verbiage. It's not a lie.
Wow. Okay. So yes, she does take a detour. Let's talk about that detour. Turns out, guys, she has a secret estate.
I like can't. The fact that Asriel doesn't know about this is mind-blowing to me.
Oh my God. Right? Okay. So it's called Athelwood. Apparently 300 years ago, Mor bought the, quote, sprawling estate and 300 pristine acres northwest of Valaris. The area is described as a land of rolling hills and burbling streams and ancient forests and crashing seas. It sounds absolutely lovely. Mm-hmm. And another lovely thing is along with this beautiful estate came 6 very rare and coveted horses. And seeing Mor ride these horses, I just love this piece of her that she loves horses. I think it works. She feels the wind in her hair and she feels free.
Well, that's what she says. She's like, I can winnow anywhere, but this feels like traveling.
Yes. It's so cool.
She's like, there's a difference. I feel the wind in my hair. Like I'm out of breath.
Yes. So fun. Also, her horse's name is Elia.
Yes.
Really cute name.
100% went to Google.
Of course you did.
In Hebrew, I don't know, Sunday school with Anna. I don't really think it means that much. It means God has answered. Answered what? I don't know.
That's interesting.
Truths? I don't know.
Truths, maybe, perhaps. Good sleuthing, nonetheless. And I love the name.
Yeah.
Okay, so the major takeaway really here from this chapter is this shadowy darkness referenced. So she is on Ilia and they are riding through the countryside. And then, quote, there, between a snarl of thorns, a patch of darkness. It did not move, did not seem to do anything but linger and watch, familiar and yet foreign. There are so many theories about what this is. Familiar and yet foreign is really interesting.
Yeah, I immediately on this reread specifically, I was like, is it Bryaxis?
Yes.
Like a familiar darkness, but like other
foreign. And
that's what I thought.
I would love if it was Bryaxis.
I do
because
too.
I feel like we have to close that circle. They're looking for Bryaxis. It's just like, we've not forgotten about you, Bryaxis. Yeah.
And she is darkness. She lives in the bottom of the library and she's missing. And I don't think it's Azriel because I think that would be a very familiar shadow that she would notice.
Yes. This has fueled a lot of conspiracy theories that Azriel does not actually love more. He has been watching her and looking at her in a way of like, I know what you're up to. You're up to something sneaky and I'm watching you. And this is his shadows. I don't think so. I think the patch of darkness is very different than a shadow.
Agreed.
You know?
Yeah. I agree.
So besides this flashback and our secret estate, the main takeaway for more in this book is really just giving us justification for where the hell she is for the entirety of Silver Flames. Rhys gives her a mission because treaty negotiations are dragging. Rhys asks more to make casual, but not so casual, visits to the key territories to remind them without saying it outright that if they push too far or enter the human realms, Valaris won't hesitate to retaliate.
Yeah.
And therefore, we don't see her for the whole goddamn book. So that's where she will be until further notice. All right, let's move along.
Okay, guys, we obviously have to touch upon Nesta.
Yes.
We are really setting us up for Akasoth here. We're at kind of a high place at the end of Akawar with Nesta, and we are starting to see the complete spiral downward, and it only gets darker from here on out.
Yeah.
So the first time we see Nesta on paper in this book, this is what Feyre notes about her. Every ounce of weight that Elaine had gained, it seemed Nesta had lost. Her already proud, angular face had turned more so, her cheekbones sharp enough to slice. Her hair remained up in her usual braided coronet. She wore her preferred gray gown, and she was, as ever, immaculately clean, despite the hovel she chose to occupy.
Oof.
I really want to note here that there are some very stark parallels between her physical and mental state and Feyre's at the beginning of Akamath.
Mm.
You know, Cassian touched upon this in Akawar of Feyre, that Nesta needs to be pushed to an extent. She can't just be left alone. And that's very similar to kind of how Rhysand treats Feyre in Akamath, right? He pushes her.
Yeah.
He's like, play with me. Let's go. And that's what I think Cassian is trying to do with Nesta, but in a very different way because they are very different people.
Yes.
But Nesta in Akawar was starting to break free of her darkness. And we saw that with the final battle, you know, and Cassian remembers that moment and that feel of Nesta covering him with her body. And she was willing to take the full brunt of Hybern's killing blow to protect him. And that's not a small thing for her to do. But the Nesta we see now is just like Cassian says, she's wounded, she's scared, she's a cornered animal. And I think it's very, very important for us to remember that Nesta going into this book is a shell of who we started to see. There is very little fight left in her, and it's very bleak.
Mm.
When we finally do get her one POV chapter in this book, this is what she says. It's after her little fight with Cassian, and she says she hadn't felt anything in months. She had days when she didn't really know where she was or what she'd done. They'd passed swiftly and yet dripped by. So did the months. She'd blinked and winter had fallen. Blinked and her body had turned too thin, as hollow as she felt.
Mm.
In this same POV, she also notes this. She's talking about the fire crackling. And her apartment is very cold because she refuses to light a fire, and for this reason. She could barely stand to hear the crack and pop of the wood, had barely been able to endure it in Feyre's townhouse. Snap, crunch. How no one ever remarked that it sounded like breaking bones, like a snapping neck, she had no idea.
Oh.
The reason she says this is because she cannot hear the sound of fire without thinking of her father, and the sound that it made when Hybern killed her father and snapped his neck.
Yes.
This is where we are with Nesta. We're starting to see, again, she's resorting back to how she was in Akatar. She's not being kind. She is taking all of her anger and bitterness out on everyone that she loved to push everyone away.
Yes.
And it is hard to read, and it's going to be hard to read in Akasoth even more so. But I was really expecting to feel the anger that I felt the first time when she confronts Cassian and doesn't want his gift.
Yeah.
And then instead, I had this overwhelming sense of sadness because it's like, look at all of the time you've spent being so mad and angry and hurting people. And it's like, keep reaching out the hand.
Yes.
And I'm excited to get to it. But for some reason this time, I felt very sad reading this.
I think that it's tricky as the reader to both want to hold her accountable for how she makes other characters feel and for her behavior outwardly.
Yeah.
But now, as a reader, we know where it's coming from, and we know the end of Silver Flames, and we've now been in her head. And the first time reading this, we haven't been in her head before.
No.
And it's really difficult, and it's something we are going to try our best to navigate, because it's very conflicting. It's hard.
Yeah.
I was furious with her still, again, this time, reading this book with the rent check thing in the bar where Feyre's come and pretty much begged her to come to Solstice, and she has been rude and mean and made her leave. And then as she's leaving, she's like, oh, by the way, my rent's due.
Yeah.
That's all I need you for. That to me was so appalling.
Yeah. Just
every time that gets me so riled up. And that being said, I still, though, did forget that she feels nothing.
Yeah.
It's bleaker than just I'm angry and I'm putting it outward. It's so sad.
It's like you want to do wellness checks on her. It's like, are you okay?
Truly.
Like, it's
truly.
Like Tamlin. Like, I don't know that you should be left alone.
It's actually a great parallel to Tamlin in this book, like the two of them.
Yeah.
But that do wellness checks thing, it just made me think of back in Akamath. Nesta was too scared to sleep because she was worried that Elaine was going to try to self-harm in some way when they were in the House of Wind, when they'd just been brought back. Mm-hmm. And that parallel to here, where Elaine in that space is being Elaine. She's not being outwardly mean.
Mm-hmm.
And Nesta in this mental place, this same darkness, different but same level of okay,
yeah,
pushes everyone away. And so instead of Elaine having people to check on her and make sure she's okay, Nesta doesn't have anyone checking on her.
No.
No one's checking on her. Cassian tries, but she just keeps pushing everyone away. She doesn't want anyone to check on her.
She's kind of set that groundwork that I don't want your help. And that's what's really hard in the difference between her and Elaine, is Elaine is this soft, sweet, docile. I mean, there's a lot more to Elaine. Obviously, we're dumbing it down.
Yeah.
Like that, it makes it easy to be there for her. And then yes. For Nesta, it is extremely difficult because just when you think you're making headway, she snaps back.
Oh, yes. She's a very difficult person to be around.
Yeah.
It really sets the tone, though, for Silver Flames. And we got 9 more months of this before Silver Flames even starts.
Yeah.
Like she
gets dark.
Does not get better.
No, it gets worse, much worse.
It really sets the tone.
Yeah.
Effectively.
Yeah, it does.
Okay, so guys, Cassian in this book, sweet boy Cassian, we didn't do much with him. He's pretty much here specifically to just set up Silver Flames. And we get a lot of him in Silver Flames, so that's okay. We do get a little bit about his backstory. It goes back to the village that his mother is from and the rubble that it now is after he got his revenge. But other important things that we get from his POVs, talk about the Blood Rite, which don't you worry, we will go into full detail in Silver Flames, but it is important that it's discussed here a little bit. We also get clues here about the unrest with the Illyrians going on right now. Again, very important groundwork. The girls are supposed to be training. They're not training. How important it is. The mission of Cassian's to get everyone to train. And it's all very important and really like emotional. The girls' training is emotional for everyone. For Cassian, for Rhys, like especially if we look at Rhys and Cassian's mothers and their backstories specifically.
Right.
We also meet Emery. Oh my God, it's so fun to see her on page.
I
was so excited. Oh my gosh. And we, in that moment, also see a little bit of this emotion coming up with Cassian as it relates to his mother mm-hmm. and the past and the Illyrian women when we see that Emery's wings have been clipped. But then she doesn't lower her gaze as Illyrian females have been ordered and trained to do, even with her clipping scars that proved that traditional ways run brutally in her family. She held his stare and it reminds him of Nesta.
I love that.
Like also the way she carries herself reminds him of Nesta, like the pose that she's in.
Mm-hmm.
And quote, Cassian had named about 24 poses for Nesta at this point, ranging from I will eat your eyes for breakfast to I don't want Cassian to know I'm reading smut. The latter was his particular favorite.
I love that one.
I loved that. And yeah, he sees this fire and this steel in Emery, and it's just really foreshadowing them becoming best friends.
Yes.
And we love, love, love to see it. Okay, so let's talk about Nesta and Cassian's big fight at the end. Here we go.
Okay, so we saw many examples of them being mates in Akawar, obviously, but they don't actually get much on page time together in this book, except for Solstice Night. And Sarah makes a point, she almost belabors the point, actually, that everyone is walking around on eggshells when it comes to Cassian and bringing up Nesta. So Solstice Night comes about. Like we said, Nesta shows up. Elaine and Feyre are both glad that she's there. Elaine guides Nesta towards a fireplace, but Nesta does not sit there. She moves to the farthest corner and sits, and she observes. And this is what Feyre notes in her POV. Nesta watched warily from her chair. Elaine's present, her only present, in her lap. Her spine stiffens slightly, but not at the words, but at Elaine, laughing with them, with us, as if Nesta were looking at us through some sort of window, as if she were still standing out in that front yard watching us in the house.
Oof.
I know.
Great writing.
Great writing. And it's really, again, going back to this idea that Nessa doesn't know how to interact.
Yeah.
How to communicate healthily. This is foreign territory to her. Discussing feelings, never heard of them.
No. Also, I think seeing Elaine become a part of the family, seeing Elaine be comfortable. She and Elaine went into the cauldron together. Mm-hmm. She always protected Elaine. And now Elaine is joining this family as well. And it's almost like, okay, well, now I really have no one.
Yeah, that was her outlet. If I can protect mm-hmm. Elaine, and if that's my sole purpose right now, that's what her focus was. And now she Elaine doesn't need her right now. So Nessa is like, cool, so where do I put all of my energy? Because I don't want to deal with my shit.
Yeah, and Elaine has now joined this family. She's able to be happy with them.
Yeah.
And Nesta just can't. She's Dear Evan Hansen waving through a window. She can't.
Yes, she really is. She really is. So at the end of the night, Nesta goes to leave. This is when Feyre hands her the check for the rent money. And it's a really hard moment. And Cassian ends up following Nesta out the door. And he insists on walking her home. And there's a couple back and forths. But what she says is, stop, she snarled. He halted in his tracks, wings spreading slightly to balance him. Stop following me. Stop trying to haul me into your happy little circle. Stop doing all of it. He knew a wounded animal when he saw one, knew the teeth they could bear, the viciousness they displayed, but it couldn't keep him from saying, your sisters love you. I can't for the life of me understand why, but they do. Oof, Cassian. If you can't be bothered to try for my happy little circle's sake, then at least try for them. A void seemed to enter those eyes, an endless, depthless void. She only said, go home, Cassian.
Mm.
And I really want to note here the specific terms that Feyre uses to describe Nesta. So Cassian calls her wounded like animal, but Feyre normally, when Nesta is snapping, she uses terms like she's being biting or she's like a snake, you know, she's a wolf, a cornered wolf.
Yes.
But now what she says, what Feyre says is it's an endless, depthless void. And it feels almost defeated. Go home, Cassian.
It feels very defeated.
I don't want to do this.
And I do think that Cassian saying the jab of your sisters love you, I can't for the life of me understand why.
Yeah, that was harsh.
I do think that was a little too far. But I do think he was doing it in a play with me, react to me way. I think he was trying to get her to react because that is better than her being in this I have no feelings void. Oof. And to be fair, she also then goes back to him and kind of like scoffs at him. She looks him up and down like he's not worth her time or her energy, like he's Illyrian scum. And, you know, they both go over the line with each other a lot.
But that goes back to the POV conversation we had at the beginning of the book, right? It's third person limited.
Oh, yeah.
So we're getting it from his point of view. That's his insecurity.
Right.
And that's the insecurity that he deals with a lot in Akasoff, right? When Eris calls him a worthless bastard or something.
Yes.
And Nessa is very much aware of that insecurity too.
Yeah. But you're right. She didn't actually say the words. She just looked at
him. No, she didn't. But still, there's a way you can look at someone. And in Cassian's point of view, that's how you take it.
Exactly.
But the two of them fight in a way. Their play with me is not like Rhysand and Feyre.
It's mean.
No, it's mean. The two of them, we've been saying this, they get off on this like, let's fight. They like the hate sex. They want that makeup sex.
And we will see that in Silver
Flames.
We will
see it.
Grab that headboard.
But this is why they are meant to be together. Because he can take it and she can take it.
Exactly. It would break other people.
Cut from the same cloth.
Yes.
Okay. So, Christina, will you touch upon Cassian's gift? Because...
Oh, yes. The only other main thing here is that Cassian got her a gift and it's in a little box and she's like, I don't want it. And pretty much she's so mean to him. She refuses the gift.
Yeah.
And it feels like a breaking point. The way the scene ends really in that moment makes him feel like, fuck it. I don't even know what else to do. I'm at the end of my rope.
Yeah.
And so at that moment, he throws the gift into the Sidra.
Oh, it's so impulsive.
And it's so sad. But it's not until Silver Flames that we find out what the present is. Okay, so he'd spent months tracking down the book. So tiny it would fit in a doll's hands, but so precious it had cost him an indecent amount of money. A miniature illuminated manuscript crafted by the skilled hands of the smallest of the lesser fae. One of the first printed books in existence. It hadn't been meant for reading, but he figured that someone who adored books as much as Nesta would savor this piece of history, even if she resented all things fae. He regretted throwing it into the river the moment it had vanished under the ice, but he had been foolish that night. Oh,
it is one of the rarest books in existence and you threw it into the Sidra.
It's the first printed book in existence?
It kills my soul.
Cassian, you jump in that river, jump in that ice, it's in a box. You maybe could have saved it quickly.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking for everybody. You're so mad at Nesta, and Cassian's impulsivity is very much his character. He's an impulsive person. He's not like Asriel or Rhysand who thinks things through.
And it sets us up. It sets us up for their book, which is where we will leave it. And we will be back with that book. We will be back with A Court of Silver Flames. That'll be our next ACOTAR Revisited episode. We cannot wait to dive in to that beautiful journey. Wow, there's a lot to it.
There is a lot.
Stay tuned for it all.
Buckle up, folks.
See you there. Bye.
See you then. Bye.
Well, friends, that wraps up another episode of Flights of Fantasy Podcast. Don't forget to join our book club community on Instagram and TikTok at Flights of Fantasy Podcast, where you can share your thoughts, theories, and favorite moments with us and fellow listeners. We'd love to hear from you. If you enjoyed today's episode, please rate and review us on your favorite podcast platform. Your support helps us spread the magic of romanticy to even more book lovers. Until next time, keep dreaming, keep reading, and remember, every good story deserves to take flight.